Lazario Ruiz versus the City of North Las Vegas, 54762. Mr. Levine?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to reserve 4 minutes on rebuttal. May it please the justices. On April 15, 2009, recently terminated police officer Lazario Ruiz filed a petition to vacate arbitration decision and remand for further proceedings. The allegations within that petition raised very serious concerns regarding violations of and implementation of Nevada's Peace Officers Bill of Rights. Those allegations were never heard on the merits. The arbitration record was never filed with the district court. The district court dismissed the matter on the ground of standing. Nevada's Peace Officers Bill of Rights contains a civil exclusionary rule, 289085. That rule requires an arbitrator or a court to exclude prejudicial information to a police officer from proceedings if the information was obtained in violation of Chapter 289's procedural protections. The arbitrator in Lazario Ruiz's case declined to exclude the evidence, and the district court would not hear the challenge because the district court believed Lazario Ruiz did not have standing. It is our position that the district court erred. Standing was conferred not only to Ruiz as a party to an arbitral proceeding, but also under two statutes. First, the district court's rationale was premised upon the Uniform Arbitration Act, NRS Chapter 38. However, if you look at the record in the case, Lazario Ruiz was a grievant. The grievant was not the NLVPOA, the Police Officers Association. It was Lazario Ruiz. Page 44 of the appendix is the request for arbitration by Mr. Cannon on behalf of the POA. And it refers to it as, please accept this correspondence as a formal presentation of Officer Ruiz's grievance in the first paragraph. The second paragraph refers to it as a collective grievance by Officer Ruiz and the POA. More significantly, if you look at the excerpt of the collective bargaining agreement, the entire agreement was not placed in the record with the district court, but the portion that was on page 55 of the record refers to an employee having a complaint or a grievance shall present the grievance to the union, and then the union grievance committee then presents the grievance to the city. But the agreement itself refers to the grievances belonging to the employee. But the court need not even decide this case on that issue. The court can also decide it under two separate statutes which confer individual standing, NRS 288-140 subsection 2 and NRS 289-120. The first statute under the Employee Management Relations Act, 288-140 sub 2, states that an employee, a local government employee, which a North Las Vegas police officer clearly is, has the right to act for himself with respect to any condition, and the statute says any condition of his employment, and with regard to adjustment of grievances, it simply says he has to comply with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. That statute has been interpreted by this court in two cases, SEIU Local 1107 versus Orr, and Cone versus SEIU Local 1107, as providing an individual with a right to forego representation. Now, the statute was cited to the district court and was dismissed on the grounds that, well, Lazario Ruiz was a member of the union, so the statute doesn't apply to him. That ignores the reality and creates an absurdity, Your Honor, because first and foremost, arguably, once Ruiz was terminated and lost his arbitration in front of the arbitrator, he's no longer a police officer. He is not covered by the collective bargaining agreement any longer, and therefore he's not a member of the union. I mean, I shouldn't say he's not covered by the collective bargaining agreement. He's not a member of the union. The representation clause in the contract says it represents police officers, not fired police officers. But if you set that aside, the absurdity is that implicit in the right to represent yourself and forego union representation, that implicit recognition shouldn't require somebody like Lizardo Ruiz to say, thank you, POA, for representing me through the arbitration. I am now going to quit the union in order to file the petition with the district court, and when I prevail, I will rejoin the union. That is the absurdity that the district court's decision would attempt to force, and that clearly wouldn't be the intent of the law. There is also a separate statute that gives Lizardo Ruiz individual standing, and that, of course, is NRS 289.120, which deals with the judicial remedy for a violation of the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights. And it states, any peace officer aggrieved by an action of the employer of the peace officer in violation of this chapter may, after exhausting any applicable internal grievance procedures, apply to the district court for relief. The statute itself, under its plain language, speaks in terms of any peace officer. It does not state any local government employee organization who is aggrieved. It doesn't state any union which is aggrieved. Had the North Las Vegas Police Officers Association filed a petition under 289.120 to the district court based upon the arbitrator's refusal to apply the exclusionary rule, that petition would have been dismissed on the grounds that the association doesn't have standing under the statute. Arguably, only Lizardo Ruiz does. The district court's rationale was premised upon two cases, one from New Hampshire and one from Ohio. That is the Leon case and the Dillman case. And what the district court wrote as the rationale
Let me, before you move on to that, isn't it a fact, though, that the 289.120 remedy, if allowed, might not, it doesn't appear that there's anything to grieve under 289 because the conduct would be covered by the by criminal activities in which the police officer was allegedly involved?
That was the ultimate issue which was intended to be addressed in the district court. It wasn't addressed by the district court below. The record itself was never filed, and the intent in bringing this was to bring before the district court the line of cases, including the case from California, which I have cited, which has interpreted California's similar, its identical provision as applying to criminal investigations primarily conducted by an agency other than the employer. But I never got to make that argument. I never got to raise or brief that case, and that issue was never developed in the district court below.
So you say there's a live remedy
There is a live remedy. It is not a moot issue. The allegation for purposes of a Rule 12b motion, and that's how this was decided by the district court, all of the allegations in Ruiz's petition had to be assumed to be true, and all reasonable inferences related thereto drawn in his favor. And one of those allegations is that when he went in to talk to the detectives after being told, you don't need a union, his questioning and answers was being secretly shown by closed circuit without his knowledge to an internal affairs officer. Obviously, if Lizardo Ruiz knew that internal affairs was involved, that would cause a reasonable officer to want to bring his union in. But again, these are all issues that were never fleshed out, never addressed by the district court below. The court decided the issue and the issue on standing only and said Ruiz does not have standing because, and I'm quoting here, sound labor policy disfavors an individual right of action because it tends to vitiate the exclusivity of union representation. Our position and my argument is the exclusivity of union representation has already been statutorily abrogated by our legislature, regardless of what they choose to do in a closed shop case in another state. In a right to work state such as Nevada, the Nevada legislature under 288.140 subsection 2 has said There is no such exclusivity. There is for bargaining purposes, but for purposes of any term or condition of your employment and adjustment of a grievance, under that statute, the individual employee has a right to pursue the grievance himself. And that, of course, has been this court's holding consistently in through Cohn versus SEIU and SEIU versus Orr. The final argument that was advanced by the district court, or the rationale advanced by the district court, is, well, Ruiz didn't grieve the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights violations. That ignores the reality of collective bargaining and how this process actually works. A grievance is actually defined under the collective bargaining agreement. A grievance, and this I'm reading from page 54 of the record where the excerpt of the collective bargaining agreement is in. A grievance is defined as a complaint regarding working conditions, wages, benefits, department rules and regulations, or interpretation and application of this agreement. A grievance is not defined as application of a statute. Moreover, if you look at the subjects of mandatory bargaining under NRS Chapter 288, subsection 288.150.2.0, grievance and arbitration procedures for resolution of disputes relating to interpretation or application of collective bargaining agreements. That is a subject of mandatory bargaining. That is what you grieve. I cannot think of any local government, county, or city that would ever agree to collectively bargain with a union over interpretation of statutes. Secondly, when it comes to the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights, a peace officer frequently will not know of a violation until after the grievance is already initiated. The grievance has, of course, a short time frame, 10 days. It is only after you file your grievance and pursue it that Officer Ruiz is going to get access to his internal affairs file and learn that internal affairs Lieutenant Justin Roberts was secretly watching his interrogation by closed circuit TV. Not only could he not grieve and is the subject of a Peace Officer's Bill of Rights not a proper subject of the grievance, a peace officer can't even know about it in most instances until after the grievance process is already initiated. I would like to reserve the additional 2:30 that I have with my 4 minutes reserved.
Okay.
Thank you. Your Honors, I appreciate the opportunity to present our side of the issues here today. I think it's very simple. And this is a matter of statutory construction. And the only way you can accept the appellant's viewpoint is if you just plainly ignore the statutes that are at issue. NRS 381-241 says, upon motion, a court for a party to an arbitration proceeding, the court shall vacate an award made in the arbitration proceeding. Okay? An absolute requirement, in order to vacate an arbitration award, you have to be a party. Under the plain language, that's what's required. Under our CBA, it says, specifically provides, in Article 23, Section 2, Step 5, provides that the association shall have the right to submit the matter for arbitration. Only the association has the right to submit the matter to arbitration. An individual employee is not granted that same right anywhere in the CBA. And they can't point to that, and they haven't. The fact that an arbitration is initially commenced by an employee as a grievance, I don't know how else it could start. I can't imagine. I guess counsel believes that the union is just going to divine that, oh, we have a problem over here, without an employee reporting that he has a grievance. I think that's patently ridiculous argument to make, that when the CBA is clear that only the union has standing to the arbitration. And also, the CBA Article 23, Section 1B provides that the procedures forth in this article shall be the exclusive remedy for disputes of complaints that is defined in the grievance here under. Okay? So that's the exclusive remedy, is arbitration by the union. The employee doesn't have any of the rights. And that's what, and as counsel ably stated, the union and the city are freely entitled, and in fact the whole statutory scheme of 288 is to provide that we don't have individual bargaining any longer. We don't have individual negotiation, and we don't have individual arbitration. As the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly stated, that negotiation and arbitration are hand in hand, the same thing, and they can't be separated. And you can't just separate and say, hey, well, we're going to let the employee grieve, you know, on his own. That would just courts have repeatedly held that that type of procedure would create havoc and be an unworkable situation. In our scene. Accordingly, under the plain language of the statute, Ruiz is not a party. And under the plain language of NRS 238-241, he has no standing. And the district court was correct in ruling so. He's pretty much waived, I guess the initial argument made in his brief was that there was a real party in interest. I guess the clear weight of authority. We cited numerous cases, in fact, the courts in their own decisions said uniformly held that employees are not parties for purposes of appealing collective bargaining grievances of arbitration awards and collective bargaining situations. Again, also Nevada statute requires that, doesn't require, but promotes the policy that this court should be uniform in its decision on how to interpret 38-241. Since all the courts are in agreement in that matter, to not follow the substantial persuasive opinions in other jurisdictions without any justification for doing contrary would not serve the ends of the statute's uniformity. Council cites two statutes as his basis for providing him party status. But then, well, we'll start with 288-140, Section 2. It says, the recognition of an employee organization for negotiation pursuant to this chapter does not preclude any local government employee. And in our brief, it's in underlying bold caps, whatever to emphasize this, who is not a member of an employee organization from acting for himself with respect to conditions of employment, but any action taken from a request for adjustment of agreement shall be consistent with its terms of an applicable negotiated agreement, if any. Now, this points to several things. Okay, first of all, okay, it's talking about first a recognition of an employee organization, okay? Because you have two steps. You know, well, there's several steps, but one step. The first step to any union and city negotiation is that employee organization has to be recognized. And so that alone doesn't prevent, just recognition of a union doesn't prevent an employee from acting for himself. And that's not surprising, because if you just recognize the union and you don't have a collective bargaining agreement yet in place, why would an employee be prevented from acting for himself? But what we have is, once the collective bargaining agreement is in place, collective bargaining agreement is what controls the procedures between the parties. And so that's why the last clause, and that he has to, if there is a collective bargaining agreement, he has to go through the grievance procedure that's provided for it. He can't just be acting, he can't just act on his own if the collective bargaining agreement provides for something contrary to that. The statute is clear that out of the things that control is the collective bargaining agreement. Okay, so now he has two insurmountable hurdles. First, under the plain language of the statute, he has to not be a member of a union organization. Well, he admits he was. And woulda, shoulda, coulda isn't enough to avoid the language of statute. I don't know how appellant argues. I'm just totally befuddled that you can say that it's absurd that he be required not to be a member of the union because when the statute says plainly they'd not be a member of the union. It's not an absurd result when that's the plain language of the statute. And it doesn't provide an absurd result because, like what I how I said before, is even if he wasn't a member of the union, still the collective bargaining agreement controls. If the collective bargaining agreement provides if the collective bargaining provides that the arbitration is exclusively between the union, such as our collective bargaining agreement between the union and the city. Cases on point on that issue, cases we cite on that is the Blackall versus City of Chicago, 703 Northeast 2nd, 47, pages 47 through 48. They had a similar Illinois statute. Nothing in this act prevents an employee from presenting his grievance to the employer and having the grievance heard and settled with the intervention of the employee organization. Basically the same kind of thing.
Could you comment on the assignment of rights issue?
Okay. With respect to the assignment of rights, to allow an employee organization to assign the rights to an appeal would frustrate the very purposes of the collective bargaining agreement. As I explained earlier, you have this situation where you have the exclusive arrangement between the city and the North Las Vegas Police Officers Association. If you allowed the employee to be assigned the rights, first of all, that would take away any incentive at all for the union to pursue grievances on behalf of the employee. You would have and so you would have these individualized claims with respect to each employee, because if you're the union, you say, well, hold it, you know, we'll just assign you the rights to grieve this matter. And so that's how we fulfill our duty of good faith to you. But as we know, this court has already held repeatedly, the union has a duty to represent its employees fairly. And it can't just take that off, overcome that obligation simply by assigning that issue to the individual employees. The one case we found on point on that is the Dillman case. There, the New Hampshire Supreme Court considered this very issue and held that an employee union could not assign its rights to petition to vacate an arbitration award. It has a similar statute to our NRS 38241, and it noted that the language of the statute, that being a party to the arbitration is a precondition to having standing to apply for an order to vacate an arbitration award. To have an assignment, then you're just manufacturing appellate standing. And as this court repeatedly has held, that the appellate standing is not something, it's something that should be like jealously guarded and should be limitedly held. Repeated cases, for example, you have the case of the attorney who was sanctioned in the district court level, and he attempted to appeal the district court's issue of sanction, and this court held, well, he wasn't a party, and so he has no right to appeal, explaining that should be jealously guarded.
Counsel,
additionally,
counsel, as was indicated in the beginning, it was brought up that we have this curious situation. We have somebody who's a member of the union. He's terminated from his employment. Therefore, he kind of no longer is a member of the union once the decision is handed down. And he wants to go the last step to pursue it to district court. Counsel's position was he's no longer part of that union. Why should he be precluded from exercising his right at this point? He's been abandoned by everyone.
He's been
thrown out.
But the thing is that's the whole purpose of the procedure. Is the union is supposed to make that decision about whether it is in the best issue of
But the union is not unemployed. This gentleman is now unemployed.
But he's also not a party to the grievance. And that's the compromise that the legislature has made in having negotiations. We provide the opportunity to have employees be represented by the union for collective bargaining purposes in order to give them greater power, in order to get greater rights from the city.
Would it be your position that his only redress should be against his union for not representing him at the final hurdle?
In fact, that is the only redress, and that's what cases have repeatedly held, that his only redress is to have a cause of action against the union for an unfair labor practice.
And
if he believes that.
And if he asserts that, then don't we get to the point that he then has a right or has standing to assert his right?
Assert his right against the city? No, Your Honor. It's the same thing with an attorney. If the attorney commits foul practice and loses the case, he doesn't have the right to go back to the original defendant and say, hey, I found out my attorney committed foul practice. I will also want a remedy from you again. He doesn't get that. He gets the remedy and he gets the damages from the attorney. I have a few minutes left. I'd like to address 289, 120, which I haven't had a chance. Again, he wants you to ignore the plain language of the statute. It says, any officer aggrieved by an actual employer in violation of this chapter may, after exhausting the applicable internal grievance procedure, grieve the procedures negotiated pursuant to the chapters of NRS and other administrative remedies applying to the district court for that judicial relief. And this is the part he excludes entirely. If the court determines that the employer has violated the provisions of this chapter, the court shall order the appropriate injunctive or other extraordinary relief to prevent further occurrence of the violation, taking reprisal or retaliatory action against the employer, peace officer. Under the statute, the arbiter has the right to make a finding whether or not that the evidence should be excluded. If the arbiter finds a violation, there is no procedure to say, well, if the arbiter made a mistake, which is what they're, I guess, arguing, there's no procedure for saying this. The statute says that this only applies to aggrievements by the employer, not aggrievements, things that the arbiter's done to you. Secondly, you got to exhaust your administrative remedies. Never did so. He wants to say, well, there's things that could have done that I maybe should have done again, but the record is clear that they didn't exhaust their administrative remedy.
Counsel, that was the point, finally, that we got to. I'd like to ask you about.
Okay.
What administrative remedies could a grievant, a peace officer, exhaust or avail themselves of under this statute and satisfy that the procedural requirement that you're talking about?
Okay. And those are the administrative remedies that are provided in the CBA. The CBA provides a 5-step grievance process, and he had to follow that.
So if we adopt your reasoning, the effect of the Peace Officers Bill of Rights statute is that although the legislature has said any peace officer aggrieved, referring to an individual, effectively has no remedy, because if they're a member of a union, they must arbitrate, and their rights are limited to the union's possession of those grievance rights and any appeals of those rights.
No, he's not left without a remedy. I mean, that's to say that arbitration is not a remedy. And the process of going through the
he's
union
left
is not a
without
remedy.
A remedy under the Peace Officers Bill of Rights statute.
Yes, that's true.
I'm asking you to focus your attention on this panel's interpretation of the Peace Officers Bill of Rights statute, and if we interpret it in the manner in which you advocate, it seems as though we read out of the statute the very specific remedy the statute seems to grant.
No, I think that's not correct, because you ignore the last sentence of the statute. The remedy with respect to the only remedy provided in the statute is prospective injunctive relief, and that's it. And cases repeatedly across the country that have defined their peace officer Bill of Rights, and I would direct this case court specifically to the City of Miami versus Cosgrove, 516 Southern 2nd, 1125, pages 1128-29, where they specifically talked about grievance process and said the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights was not intended to provide some type of monetary remedy or any other remedy other than injunctive relief to prevent future occurrences of violations of the Police Officer's Bill of Rights against that particular officer. And the end of the last language of our statutes, it specifically provides that. It says, the courts, if the court determines an employer has violated the provision of this chapter, the court shall order appropriate injunctive relief or other extraordinary relief. It doesn't provide for different remedies. And as this court is well aware, under the terms of statutory construction, when the legislature has specifically enumerates one remedy and does not name other remedies, the legislature intended that to be the exclusive remedy.
Well, then that leads to my next question. If we accept your argument that the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights statute provides only prospective relief, then doesn't that necessarily beg the question as to why the statute refers to other prior grievance procedures?
Well, and like I said, I think it's a recognition. In fact, it cites 288. It's a recognition that there may be procedures under the collective bargaining agreement. For example, he noted that the working conditions. Well, if we're providing working conditions that are contrary to 289, I believe that would be grievable. That's something that bring forth, and I can't say for certain because, to be honest, I really don't have a specific instance in mind. But
well, I guess
I'm
point
sure that that's something that has been grieved in the past.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's hard to find a fact pattern that fits within the interpretation of the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights statute you offer, because if it's a working condition issue, you would advocate that the statute should be interpreted that this is something that's grievable through the union process, and if it has been, then the officer has no right to pursue any remedy under the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights statute for continuing work condition violations.
Well, no, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree.
Especially
if we continue to violate the officer's Peace of Bill of Rights, I think that then that's where he gets to have the injunctive relief from the court.
I needed to add one fact to the
pattern.
The arbitration agreement, the arbitration ruled against the union and said there's no adverse working conditions. So under those circumstances, you would say that the peace officer has no right to seek any remedy for the prospective work condition violation.
Yeah, and if the arbiter made such a finding and that was a final decision, Your Honor, I believe that's right, but I believe that that's the balance the legislature struck when it specifically put in the statute that you follow the grievance procedures under 288.
So you would suggest then that the legislature's intent, although characterizing this statute as the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights, was really a fairly narrow set of rights.
I wouldn't say a narrow set of rights. I would say a narrow set of remedies.
Narrow set of remedies for these great rights we've just extended to you. Okay.
And Your Honor, though, that's not unusual, though. We find all kinds of statutes. For example, I mean, we have the Bill of Rights. The entire Bill of Rights are not self-executing rights. In other words, you don't get damages or get any relief from them except for prospective injunctive relief until they pass 42 U.S.C. 1983. And so it's not unusual.
Right. Was there anything else you wanted to comment about?
Well, I have. I could go on for minutes more, but since my time has run up, I'll stand with in your good graces.
Okay. Thank you.
Your Honor, I want to read a quote from Cone, this court's decision 10 years ago regarding 288.140 sub 2. The statute explicitly authorizes a non-union member to act on his own behalf, quote, with respect to any condition of his employment, close quote. The statute provides an individual with a right to forego union representation. The issue is, who is going to represent Lazario Ruiz before the district court? Lazario Ruiz determined that he wanted to forego having the union attorney represented before the district court on an issue relating to an exclusionary rule and wanted to retain private counsel. And that is what he did. It would not be unusual. Let me give you a circumstance. You have a small department, Esmeralda County Sheriff's Department, which may be very small, have a small union, perhaps, not a lot of resources, and perhaps an officer says, I want a criminal attorney, somebody versed in the applicable rules under the Fourth Amendment and the exclusionary rule traditionally applied. Why shouldn't an officer have a right, if he has a right under the statute to forego representation, to go and get an expert in an area? The two cases, and I want to bring up a point because the breach of the duty of fair representation was raised by this court in arguments from the City of North Las Vegas. Both Dillman and Leon, the cases relied upon by the district court, found that even in cases where where there is no applicable statute like 288.140, there are always exceptions because you don't leave the employee without a remedy. In fact, in Dillman, if there's a breach of the duty of fair representation, the employee does have a right directly to challenge the arbitrator's decision. That's what the Dillman case out of Ohio says. But so what the city is arguing for is, because in this particular case, the union agreed and assigned the rights, you can do it. The city wants to create a scenario whereby an employee has to bring an unfair labor charge, has to fight with his own union, has to bring a claim for the breach of the duty of fair representation only to vindicate his own rights. And that is a legal absurdity. And that's why, and because the case Leon, which did not recognize an assignment, doesn't have an applicable provision to 288.140, it's not applicable to this case.
Before you sit down, I was wondering if you could address counsel's argument under the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights that your client hasn't satisfied or exhausted administrative procedures in order to avail himself of the opportunity under that statute.
He has. The administrative remedy is the grievance process. It is a three-step grievance process. Step one, step two, final step, arbitration. That is the administrative remedy. There is no remedy under Chapter 288. You cannot file a claim for an unfair labor practice with the Employee Management Relations Board for a violation of 289. I have had a number of cases where Mr. Davis himself stands up in cases I have against the objection. This board has no jurisdiction under 289. That has long been the department's position. The EMRB, and I don't want to preview too much, but it's coming to you. There is a case where the EMRB declines jurisdiction over 289. That's working its way through the district court right now. The only remedy, administrative remedy, is the grievance process, and it is undisputed that Lazario Ruiz did exhaust it. He went all the way through the arbitration, got a decision, and there is nowhere left but the district court.
Let's assume for the moment that the court accepts that point of view. The remedy does seem to be rather limited, though, under that statute. If you find standing under that statute, the remedy looks only at some prospective injunction.
I don't believe that that is a correct reading of the statute. What it says, it's two parts. It does not say the district court may only grant prospective relief. It says you may apply to the district court for judicial relief. And then the second clause says if the court finds it a violation, it shall enjoin further violations. But I don't believe the statute can be read as narrowly as the city would like to say that the only remedy is prospective. Moreover, you can never get the prospective remedy, and the city would be allowed to continuously violate the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights if you don't allow the standing issue in the first place.
So I guess maybe I didn't articulate this adequately when I questioned Mr. Davis, but the point I was trying to drive at is it seems as though if one accepts the city's argument that the remedy is only prospective under the second section, then because of the structure of the statute and because the administrative process really is the grievance and arbitration process, there really is no remedy under the statute, because you would always go back to the arbitration process. There'd be an adjudication of that. Nothing to address prospectively.
If you accept the city's argument. However, this court has long held that the state should, of course, follow the lead of federal labor laws. At the seminal cases, Baca versus Seitz, Del Costello versus the International Brotherhood of Unions, always makes clear it was never the intent of the federal Congress to deprive an employee of a full remedy, and that's why when there's a breach of the duty of fair representation, the employee can go directly and file suit. Labor law has always favored a full remedy, and 289 is really a labor statute. It provides that it's a ceiling below which no law enforcement agency may go below, but of course you can always negotiate for greater rights, and I think it needs to be read in accordance with labor policy and labor statutes. I know I'm well over my time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Davis, we afforded to him some additional time. I'll give you a minute if you would like to comment on any of the court's questions during rebuttal.
Well, speaking about absurd results, what would be an absurd result would be to overturn the arbitration, the vacating of arbitration awards provided for in 38241, using statutes that don't even mention arbitration awards. That would be the absurd result. I don't think the legislature wouldn't create this uniform law and this uniform situation about how you appeal it, and then say, well, in this statute we're going to change this without even mentioning the appeal process. Again, he also talks about that that the peace officer has, that the peace officer doesn't have any remedies or rights, but that's not true. I disagree with the entire premise that the arbitration process isn't a right. It might not be the same right that you have in district court, but I think that the whole union process is to create short, definite decisions without going through the entire legal expense that Mr. Levine would have the city do and the union do and have every employee do. We'd be subject to innumerable rights if the employee continues to just be able to say, well, I'm just going to appeal this one on my own.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel, for your excellent arguments here this morning and your briefs. We appreciate them. Always a spirited debate between you two. We wish you all a happy holiday, and the case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until the next call.